Welcome to In the Hive, I'm Roger McDonough. Maybe you're aware that there's a push underway to overhaul Utah's tax system. Lawmakers are trying to address a perceived structural imbalance in how taxes come in and are allocated. For the majority of today's show, we're going to focus on just one aspect of the proposal currently under consideration by Utah lawmakers, an increase in the tax on food. Senator Lyle Hilliard, one of the co-chairs of the Tax Restructuring and Equalization Task Force, will tell us why that food tax increase is in the draft proposal. And Alex Cragen with Utahns Against Hunger will tell us why he wants it out of that proposal. But before we get there, we're going to do a quick 5-minute overview on why the push for tax reform is even happening. And to help me with that, I'm joined by Natalie Gochner. Hi, Natalie.
Great to be with you, Roger.
In addition to being one of the hosts of Both Sides of the Aisle, which is coming up next here on KCPW, Natalie is also an economist who directs the University of Utah's Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute, which is often consulted by the legislature on issues of economics. Natalie, I'm just going to leave this to you to explain why lawmakers are trying to tackle tax reform. What's driving that? Why are they doing it, and why now?
We have a tax system, particularly the sales tax, that is a depression-era tax that has not been modernized to match the current economy. We have legislators who recognize that right now we have plenty of revenue, things are going well in the state, but could we use this very prosperous time to make some needed reforms in our tax system? And the sales tax is the target of that.
The target of that, and that's because of this, and we hear a lot about it, structural imbalance in the tax system and how taxes come in and are allocated. What is this imbalance?
Yeah. Well, I think for listeners to think about it is we built our tax system in state government off of what they call the three-legged stool, sales, income, and property tax. Property tax is the most stable, and it's good to have that stability in the mix. Sales tax responds to the economy. It's very responsive. Goes up in good times and down in bad times. And the income tax is really based on ability to pay. It has some progressivity in it. Even with a flat tax because of the credits, it has progressivity in it. So the idea is that those three taxes create our mix of balance in stability and in responsiveness and the like. Well, the sales tax is under attack. It is a tax on goods. We're moving to a service economy. And so sales taxes as a percent of the economy have dropped from 67% to 42%. Okay, that's a problem. And that means it's not tracking with the economy. And the economy is what government services, roads, education. As the economy grows, you need your revenues to grow.
And that the trend is down for the sales tax, and so we're losing more and more opportunity to sort of right that balance. Where is property tax in all of this, Natalie?
Yeah. Well, property tax is mostly a local government revenue, right? It's for school districts and for special service districts and, libraries, mosquito abatement, that kind of thing. And so it's not really a state revenue source, but it's an important revenue source in the full mix. The two big things at the state are sales tax and income tax. In the current proposal, they're doing a lot of things to try and help with these structural imbalances and the like. But I think a thing that listeners should think about is the very easiest thing for the legislature to do is just to kick the can down the road and not deal with it. Tax reform is difficult. It creates winners and losers by definition. Okay, it's not reform if all you do is give everybody a cut. That's a tax cut. But reform means that you're actually trying to change the way the system works. And so while the sun's shining, they're trying to fix the roof. And I think it's a very challenging thing, but it's also a really important thing for our long-term economic health in the state.
Do you have any, you are a source for the legislature, for lawmakers on this through the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. Do you have positions on any of the specific proposals that they are considering? I mean, it's a massive document.
Yeah.
And there are things like raising the sales tax on food, which we're talking about today. There's the potential for removing the earmark from the income tax on education. Do you take a position on any of these things, or are you sort of a step back and watch?
The Gardner Institute is really in what I would call the light world. We are very data-driven. We share a lot of information that sheds light to help decision-makers make good decisions. There are others that are in the heat world who lobby and advocate. We don't do that. We basically put out information and help people to get greater understanding. I'll give you an example. Sales tax on food, it's lower in our state. The current proposal wants to put it at the full rate. that is, you know, uncomfortable to a lot of people. But I will just tell you that our state gave a $250 million tax cut when they lowered the sales tax on food with the policy objective of helping low income. The low income benefit from reducing the sales tax on food is $30 million. So we gave up $250 million in revenue to give a $30 million, you know, objective or policy objective. So this current proposal does a lot of things to target that policy objective to those in greatest need. And so that's a real big part of the discussion, is trying to understand our low-income Utahns advantaged if they have a much richer benefit, but it's not off of the food tax.
And that's something that we're going to dig into on this show today. Natalie Gochner, director of the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah, thanks for making time.
Yeah, pleasure.
Okay, you hopefully have a better grasp of the push for tax reform than you did 5 minutes ago. Now, though, we're going to dig into one very specific aspect of what lawmakers are mulling over, a proposal to increase the food tax from 1.75% to 4.85% to bring in about $250 million in new revenue. What that would actually do is restore the full tax on food that was reduced back in 2007, when John Huntsman Jr. helped shepherd that reduction through. Huntsman, by the way, is quoted in the Deseret News as still being in favor of keeping the food tax low. So why increase it? Well, according to Senator Lyle Hilliard, co-chair of the Tax Task Force, because of that imbalance Natalie Gochner was just describing. Here's my conversation with Senator Hilliard. Senator Lyle Hilliard, thanks very much for making time for this conversation this morning.
Glad to do it.
One part of this tax reform push is the focus of what we're talking about today on this program, which is increasing the tax on food. That's moving it from the 1.75% realm to 4.85%. And I want to start with a really open-ended question, Senator Hilliard, which is, how did the Tax Reform Committee land on increasing the food tax as a component of the reform that you were hoping to enact? Why is that in there?
Let me correct or clarify one point you made.
Sure.
Currently, with the 3 cents we took off a number of years ago, people are paying about 4 cents on their food, unprepared food now. There's kind of a perception out there that we're going to put sales tax back on food and we've not had it. Actually, it's been reduced from the 7 to 4, and there's some few cents off there. So what we're going to do is our proposal would take the 4 current and move it back up to 7. So I want to make sure that's clear, because I get some people thinking that we're tripling the amount of sales tax on food without understanding that in the context, it's going to be increased less than half of what it is right now. I voted against removing sales tax on food when that initial came to the legislature for 3 what I thought to be very good reasons, and those 3 reasons are still there. First of all, that food is a solid base in our sales tax base, and by taking it out or removing that part of it, it makes our revenues less stable, and I think we've seen that over the years, that sales taxes has lost its stability to some extent because of that. Second, I think it's a very inefficient way to help the poor, and I'll give you some figures that'll point that out to you. And third, it's the only tax some people pay. And we talk about the illegals or undocumented who may not have Social Security numbers and maybe paid cash. There's a lot of Americans here who purposely choose not to be paid through a bank account so that they don't have to pay income tax. And many of those people obviously have a hard time avoiding sales tax when they buy groceries in the store, and so that's pretty part of the collection. We decided to put it back in, and let me give you some figures that drove our decision. We were told by our staff that if we add this 3 cents back into the sales tax base, it will increase general fund about $250 million. Now, they also told us that the poor, and I think they defined that in a way that really is pretty low, we'll be paying about $30 million of that $250 million. So that means that roughly $220 million will be paid by people above the poor line, people who are making $75,000, $100,000, whatever it may be, who buy steaks instead of hamburger, who buy more expensive item food, gets the same 3% tax break, and we want to remove that. So now we can target in and make it effective for the poor. First thing we are proposing that there'd be a food tax credit, and that would be $125 per person in the household of a family making less than $45,000. We're told by our staff that that will give a tax refund of $125 million, substantially more than the $30 million that they're paying. In addition, we are concerned about those people who are living on a fixed income like Social Security, so we're going to remove the last vestiges of taxing Social Security for those people who are on that fixed income. So it'll be limited only to those people who have a problem because they have such little money. That's going to refund $18 million. Then we're going to address a thing called intergenerational poverty. That's where the grandparents, the parents have been on welfare. Now we have the grandchildren, and we're going to break that cycle of poverty. So we're going to give an earned income tax credit, like the federal government does. Ours would be 10% of that, and that's $6 million. So in the $30 million more that these poor people are going to have to pay for sales tax on food, we're giving back to the people $150 million. Argument is made. Some people don't file income tax returns, and so therefore they can't get it. We're going to have a very simple form they can get online. I'm sure most accounting firms are going to have it. You can fill it out, send it in, and get your $125 or $250, how many people there may be in your family. Currently, we have about 30% of Utahns who qualify for Medicaid who don't take it. And I haven't heard the argument yet that we ought to do away with Medicaid because these poor 30% don't apply for it. They may not apply for it because they don't know about it. They may don't feel like they want to have a handout from the government, whatever it may be. We can work and try to help those, but we shouldn't penalize the rest of the people just because there's some people who choose, for whatever reason, not to do it. So I think we've handled that really pretty well.
Can I ask just for a second if there? I know that one of the concerns out there is that at some point in the future, you know, right, the grocery tax credit might go away because of that disuse or for whatever reason that while the tax might remain, the grocery tax credit might not stick around. Does that make any sense? Is that a...
Yes, okay. And that's always a concern of everything. And I tell people, I remember back with John Huntsman Jr., we cut the income tax rate from 7 to 5%. And when we did that, we had a lot of concern, oh, no, you're just going to bump it right up again. We don't trust you. We have not. It's been over 10 years that it's been at that 5%. In fact, we've lowered it to 4.95%. So I think I can't say forever nothing ever is going to happen, but I would really say I think the commitment of the legislature has been pretty well historically that when we do these kinds of things, we don't just bump them right back up.
So speaking of Governor John Huntsman Jr., the food tax was lowered under his, you know, he sort of shepherded that through. And I read in the Deseret News that he's still in favor of keeping the food tax low. Does that make this harder to do at all?
You know, I don't think so, because when we did the sales tax on food, it was a compromise between the House and the Senate. We also did the income tax as part of that package. It lowered the income tax and lowered the sales tax on food. At a time, we had substantial surpluses in both our education fund and our general fund. Other thing I need to really point out, why we're doing all of this, is that our general fund is not keeping up with our needs and growth in population. And it's because, number one, people are spending less on goods that are subject to sales tax and more on services. I heard a report saying that we're getting older, and as people get older, they spend more of their money on health care and travel, those kinds of things that are not taxed, and not on buying new refrigerators or new stoves or new cars or those kinds of things. So that's changed dramatically. We've already factored in most of the money that we're going to get from out-of-state online sales. So people say, wait until that's clear. Most of that had been worked in. It's already built into our budget. Even then, I tell people when the revenues come out, hear the revenues, ask yourself two questions. Number one, how much is ongoing and how much is one time? We make a mistake. Last year we talked about $1.3 billion initially of being new revenue. Well, only about half of that was ongoing. And only the ongoing can you really use for ongoing programs that you really need to help. Then ask yourself the second question, how much is education money and how much is general fund? Last year, it was about 85% education money, about 15% general fund. To give you some perspective, if we have, let me just take a figure, of $550 million of new revenue ongoing next year, if it turns out that $500 million is income tax and only $50 million is general fund, then that $50 million has to pay for all health and human services, clean air initiatives, cleaning up the Rio Grande, public employee salaries. Well, in fact, $50 million will pay about a 2% salary increase for all public employees, plus their health and retirement benefits. We're done. And so we've got to do everything we're doing here is moving what would be sales tax breaks into income tax reductions, because income tax, although all of it has always gone to education, it's never been enough to fund education. We have to supplement income tax every year with general fund money, with property tax, 2/3 of your property tax goes for public education, and with about $60 million next year from profits from liquor sales. So when public education comes and says you're cutting our sources, we're hurting them if we don't keep the general fund viable, because income tax is up right now, but historically it's really been very volatile. And so I'm concerned doing budgets that when this income tax turns down, if I cannot turn to sales tax or general fund to help me out, we're going to be really in a pickle. So I think that's what we're trying to avoid. Right now, I love a thing I heard from Natalie Gochner, you repair your roof when it's sun shining. And we've done some things in anticipation of problems. Olean Walker did. She really fought in the House to get a rainy day fund. Had a lot of flack. We need the money. We can't be saving any. She persevered and got it. We built it up over the years. And I'll tell you, in 2007, when the economy went south, we were so thankful we had a rainy day fund that we were able to bring the state out of its miseries much quicker than most any other state.
Can I ask, there's a couple questions I want to get to before I have to let you go. And you brought up a lot of issues right there, including the earmark on education, a topic worthy of an entirely different show. But what I'm wondering, I guess, is there a chance that the food tax itself could come out of this proposal by itself? Given, I'm just thinking about some of the opposition that's out there. And of course, you have opposition on a variety of fronts from various vested interests. But on this one particular issue, is that something that could somehow be left aside?
If it did, it would remove $250 million off the table, which, like I said, if we only have, again, the illustration, if we only have $50 million of general fund, you're going to be thankful if we can pull that $250 million from the sales tax on food and add it to the general fund. Now we have $300 million, and that makes a whale of a difference when you're trying to balance budgets. If we don't do it, then we've got to find some other source to fund it, or simply not fund in the areas of general fund, the health and human service budgets. It's really pretty critical.
Final question, which is, this is a big, messy issue, and there are a lot of things in this proposal that won't be popular, that will have specific industries opposing changes. And it's a very simple question, but do you think you can get this done?
I would hope so. Let me tell you, quite frankly, I'm disappointed with our product, because I think we really needed to expand the sales tax into the service area that is growing, not goods are not growing. And until we face that as a state and do it, or until we can remove this dedication of income tax to public education so we can really work on a viable general fund, we're going to be in trouble. We really, with our proposals, we basically kick the can down the road maybe four or five, six years, and then we're going back in the same place, because general fund has not been really filled and done as we should do. So, it's going to be messy, and I'm sure there's going to be opposition to it. I think my biggest disappointment, too, is when people have made comments to me, both email, letters, telephone calls, public meetings, they really are not very informed. They have not read and understand the bill, and we've tried to do that, and it gets sloughed off, oh, you're just a propaganda roadshow. Listen to what we're saying. Listen to what the experts are saying. I think we've done a pretty good job on it.
All right. Senator Lyle Hilliard, thank you very much for making time and for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much.
Again, Senator Hilliard says increasing the food tax is basically part and parcel of the whole reform. That, as you just heard, a lot of the changes are going to be unpopular, but they might still be needed nevertheless. Now, though, we'll turn to a conversation I had this week with someone who has a different take on this issue. Alex Cragen, food security advocate with Utahns Against Hunger. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Roger.
One part of the proposed tax overhaul at the state legislature is an increase in the food tax, or as the sponsors of this proposal put it, the restoration of the full food tax. Mm-hmm. For you and your organization, this is a no-go. Why?
So, I mean, there are a number of reasons. One, if you look at the history of the sales tax on food, in 1980, there was a ballot initiative to eliminate that. In 1990 as well, both failed by about 6%. Overall, Utahns disapprove of the sales tax on food. Looking back at polling, nothing's ever dipped below 60%. So it's been a historically backed opposition with regard to sales tax on food.
And so this is, I mean, you're talking about proposals, historic proposals to completely eliminate the sales tax on food.
Mm-hmm.
And that hasn't happened here.
Yeah, no. And I mean, like Governor Leavitt supported this. John Huntsman, when he was running for governor, he received the nomination and was elected based on this issue as well. Mm-hmm. And then flash forward a couple of years later, in 2007, the state went and reduced the sales tax on food incrementally to the point where we're at right now, which is 1.75%. Okay. Now, since then, the state has looked at increasing this over a number of years, particularly in 2011, most recently in 2017. There has been strong opposition in the House with regards to this. In 2018, actually, there was a bill, HB 148, sponsored by Representative Tim Quinn of Heber, passed the House overwhelmingly and then subsequently didn't go anywhere in the Senate. And so there's a lot of broad support for the elimination or maintenance of the current tax rate here in the state of Utah.
What is the having a low tax rate or conceivably no tax rate? But let's look at what we've got today currently. What does that do?
So right now, where we're at is a small amount of money, but nevertheless does impact people. Studies have shown, one done by Auburn University, that for every 1% the sales tax on food increases, food insecurity in a state goes up by 0.6%. And right now we're looking at a population that is food insecure is about 363,000 to 373,000 Utahns, majority of which are children, seniors, people with disabilities, and vulnerable populations. And these are not just like low income. These are also middle income individuals that have a tight budget. You know, the food budget in a family is the most flexible part of their budget. And so when you need to go and, you know, make an additional payment on your credit card or make a car payment or make sure that you're making rent, people draw from their food budget to cover those things. And so they often forego things like fresh fruits and vegetables for things like potatoes, ramen noodles, things that are high sodium, you know, and not necessarily nutritionally dense. And so what you see in terms of the health outcomes of individuals that are food insecure, higher healthcare costs, longer hospitalization rates, you know, mortality rates decrease, also educational attainment for children. There's difficulty there. Job attainment is also an issue there. You know, the state of Utah has been looking at issues that factor into how someone falls into poverty or how someone is in poverty. And one of the things that we haven't really had a conversation around is food insecurity. And that's one of those early determinants. And we've been doing a lot of this great work around those issues and addressing things like housing and utilities. And to go and look at increasing the sales tax on food is a step back from that process. We see Utahns Against Hunger see the sales tax on food as a moral issue. We think it's immoral to tax essentials to living, and food is one of those. You know, part of the argument is that everybody eats,
right,
and therefore we should be taxing it as a fair tax, but in all actuality, it's regressive in that lower-income households, middle-income households spend more of their money covering their food budget than those that are higher income. They'll experience a higher burden there than those that are making, you know, more money.
This is a very specific issue in a much broader tax overhaul, and part of the plan from the sponsors of this legislation is that we could mitigate the impacts of increasing that tax on food by offering a grocery store credit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a credit you would get when you do your taxes to offset the impact of increasing the sales tax on food. What's your response to that part of this proposal?
So first and foremost, the fact that they recognize the need for a grocery tax credit says that this is the wrong thing to do, that they know this will cause harm, right? But to the tax credit itself, in terms of a policy perspective, there's a lot of concern with regards to outreach to communities, you know, letting them know this exists. You know, not everybody has the ability to pay attention to the news like some of us are fortunately able to. You have individuals that don't file taxes, and, you know, how are we going to educate them about this grocery tax credit? Because the idea is that you'll be able to go and file with the tax commission and get that refund regardless of your tax filing status.
In April or in February or whenever you do your taxes.
Exactly. And so our concern there is like those individuals missing out on that. There's a lot of concern about, you know, the notion that it's a one-time credit during the month of February and April. And so somebody gets that and they're good. And maybe in some, you know, hypothetical world, they put that in a savings account and I don't know, they draw from that monthly to kind of cover that burden. But in all actuality, people don't necessarily live like that. And you know, a grocery tax credit won't cover that. There's issues around the stability of a tax credit. You know, if we experience an economic downturn or a budget shortfall, you know, a lot of these kinds of programs are the first things to go. If you look at other states like Kansas, for example, they experienced a budget shortfall in 2011, and they had to restrict their grocery tax credit to the point that it was completely unusable. I mean, they had a $61 million program in terms of their rebate as a state. After the reforms, it became a $6 to $7 million program. I mean, and of the, there was like 352,000 households that qualified for this program, and only 52,000 applied for it. And so it basically was no longer a viable program to address this issue. And so people were being left with this additional burden and no way to relieve it. Mm-hmm. And so our concern is, you know, not only will people not necessarily know about the credit itself, but will this credit last the length of time? Like, you know, will
Is there a guarantee that it will persist?
Right. Yeah. And you know, we don't necessarily see that as you know, because there are larger social programs that are very important that need to be covered, like Medicaid, education. You know, there are lots of other things out there. And, you know, these are one of those kind of like low-hanging fruit to tighten budgets during budget shortfalls.
Well, so Senator Lyle Hilliard, who's one of the co-chairs of the Tax Restructuring and Equalization Task Force, says that there's more than, you know, just the grocery credit. There's also the reduction in the income tax, a credit for Social Security recipients. There's the earned income tax credit for families who are affected by intergenerational poverty. Does the rest of that, you know, sort of lean, I guess what I'm trying to say is, does that quell your worried mind, Alex? You know, is there?
I mean, no, because there are individuals that are single that not necessarily going to get that child exemption. Right. You know, there are people that are couples that won't be getting some of these exemptions as well. I mean, there are people, again, that don't file taxes that won't be experiencing these benefits. And so there's a large swath of this community that won't necessarily benefit from all of this tax package. And, you know, there's some great things in this bill that we should be seriously considering. And then there are things like the sales tax on food, which gives us significant pause as an organization. I mean, frankly, right now, I mean, we've only seen this draft of this bill that's been shifting over the course of a month. You know, we've been talking about this for the last 9, 10 months. But now is like the first time we're actually seeing concrete examples of this policy. And now we're looking at December 9th being the final date for the for an up and down vote from the committee itself. And then 3 days later, a special session on the cusp of a general session. You know, this is a very large issue. There's a lot of lifting that's going on in this. And this seems to be much more of an appropriate time for a general session conversation rather than a special session. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of moving parts, moving portions of this. There are a lot of people that are going to be affected by this. I mean, Keith Prescott, who's been a long-term tax policy wonk, said himself in committee last week that Utah deserves better than this process. And, you know, I would agree with him. I think that there's you know, a lot going on in this, and people need to be aware of what's going on, how it's going to affect them, and there needs to be more education about this particular piece of legislation. We've been having this conversation and kind of educating ourselves on like what could be possibly part of this piece of legislation, but we haven't really drilled down to, you know, an actual final bill to have that conversation until recently.
Alex Cragen with Utahns Against Hunger. Really appreciate your time today.
Roger, thank you.
So what are your thoughts on the food tax or on the tax reform push in general? Weigh in at this week's In the Hive show post at KCPW's Facebook page. And that does it for In the Hive today. Our theme music is by Andrew Shaw. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at our website, kcpw.org, or through whatever podcast app you use to listen. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in. Both Sides of the Aisle is coming up next.